Welcome. I laugh up. I'm stuck to see if you would.
Maybe I should introduce you.
Yes. Handle the cards. Amutu Baha Ruhiya Kanum. Mrs. Natchivani. Rizwan Mukbil, Chairman of the National Spiritual Assembly. Welcome this visit to Mull. A very short visit. Ruhiya Kanum would like to speak to the friends for a short while. After some time after the talk, then we can possibly have some coffee and eat together and socialise a little. Hopefully there'll be a little time just to show Ruhiya Kanum and my guests run about the island, hopefully. But the plane leaves at 6 o'clock, so everything.
How did you find that out? I never heard about it.
You didn't?
No. That's interesting. Now we know.
We have people in important places. Friends.
I'm very happy to be here today. And I'm sorry that the visit is so short, but frankly, I didn't know that Mull existed. And all I knew that there were some things called the Shetland Islands, the Orkney Islands, and the Hebrides. And at the youth conference where I was at the beginning of this particular trip to England, I met with three members of the National Assembly. Philip Hainsworth was there, Dr. Mokbel was there, and Mary Hardy. And I said, look, I have a little time, and all my years since the crusade of Shoghi Effendi and this area being set as gold, you see, these islands, to be settled and opened by the Baha'is, I'd wanted to come up here. And I'd heard so much about the Baha'is, and I knew that it was very far away and that it was very difficult, that it wasn't as easy as all that for people to come up to these islands and teach the faith of Baha'u'llah, especially as the people were very insular and conservative. And I'd thought of them a great deal all these years, and I wanted to come, but nothing ever sort of materialized. It didn't become in focus, so to speak, in my mind. And then suddenly, having vowed that I wouldn't open my mouth until next year, after giving so many talks on this trip through Central America and the Caribbean islands and the States and Canada and so on, and getting so tired, frankly, of the sound of my own voice, I said, now I'm going to shut up. And I don't intend to give any more talks till next year, literally. So what came over me to suggest that I should come up and see all the Baha'is in these islands and open my mouth again, I don't know. But the National Assembly was very pleased about it, and we arranged this trip. And Philip Hainsworth said, oh, but you've got to go to the Inner Hebrides. I said, what are they? Well, he said, there's the outer and there's the inner. And there are Baha'is in the Inner Hebrides, and you should go and see them too, you see. Well, I said, well, all right, if they exist, I'd be very glad to go there. I really didn't know anything about it, you see, just something Hebrides off the west coast of the British Isles. That's all I knew about it. So if I'm here today, you really owe it primarily to the soft heart of Philip Hainsworth, that immediately, you know how what a big mouth he has and how quickly he can jump into something, and he jumped right into me and said, oh, but you can't do that. You've really got to go and see the Baha'is there too. You can't have that, you see. So I said I would be delighted. And this was what we arranged, and I'm very, very happy. And I would like to say that I didn't come here to see the island. I came here to see the Baha'is. And I don't have to go and see the island. I haven't seen any of the other islands, so why should I see Mull? I've only seen the Baha'is in the other places. I didn't even see those standing stones yesterday in Stornoway, which I would have liked to have seen very much. You haven't any standing stones.
I have a few.
Really? Yeah. A whole circle of them?
No, not the circle.
Oh, well, I won't settle for less. Anyway, the point is that you got one of those keeps?
No, I don't think we have a keep, no.
Well, anyway, whatever it is, I didn't come here to go sightseeing or to see things like that, much as I would like to. So we have till 6 o'clock. And if we find that everybody's exhausted, and we want to drive around a little bit at the end, that's another subject, but in the meantime, let's have a good time together. And at the end of whatever it is I say, I think that it'd be very nice to have questions, because often people do have questions, and one question leads to another question and has a stimulating effect, at least on the speaker. Looking at these flowers, I remembered something that happened last night. The Baha'is there also had only one opportunity, you see, because the plane service was all full. We couldn't go for two nights to Stornoway, so we missed the whole first afternoon and evening and morning. And we only had yesterday afternoon and evening, and then of course we got up and packed and finished and went to the airport this morning in order to get here. So their time ended up in being about the same length of time that we're going to have together this afternoon. And they decided that they would have a meeting with not only the Baha'is, who as you know are very few in number, but with some of their friends. And we had about 30 people come. And it was a very, very nice meeting, a very friendly atmosphere. The people in these islands are very friendly people, I've found. And we had a lovely time. And afterwards, I went and sat down to a man who is very prominent in reviving the Gaelic language, very fine person, school teacher, a friend of the Baha'is. And he told me a story which suddenly came back to my mind, and I thought it was so beautiful. I'd been saying how Baha'u'llah says that the city is the home of the body, but the country is the home of the soul. And how I thought that nowadays it had reached the point where it's very hard to believe in God. Not impossible, certainly, but difficult, I would say, to believe in God in the great cities. Because there's nothing to remind you of God. There's nothing that would make you feel that he was important. You'd feel that man and his civilization was urgent and important, but you wouldn't think very much about God and his creation. You wouldn't feel that that was in focus, so to speak, in the cities nowadays. And people are so rushed, they are so preoccupied, they are so busy, they live in such a perfectly horrible environment, physically and mentally, I should say, to a great extent because of the deterioration of our civilization, that it's, to me, difficult for people to believe in God, relatively speaking, in the cities. But the opposite is true of the country. And I think that when you go close to nature, it's very difficult not to believe in God. Now, however you believe in him may be conditioned by your ancestors or whatever church you come from or your own philosophical ideas. But it's very difficult not to believe in a creator when you come close to his creation. And this man afterwards told me this perfectly beautiful story. He said that near Stornoway, in the village where he was brought up as a child, there was an old man that had a shop. And that he could remember that one of the things this old man always did with anybody that came into the shop, he'd get around to asking in a sort of a vague way, well, now tell me, do you believe in anything, you know, up there? So usually, of course, people would say, well, yes, I do believe in something up there. And then he'd say, well, how do you know? What proof have you? And he never got any kind of an answer that satisfied him. But he said once an Indian peddler came in, East Indian peddler, and he asked him these questions, and the man believed in something upstairs. And then he said, well, how do you know, you see? Have you any proof? And he said the man walked out of the shop, went across the street to a field, picked a daisy, and came back and just handed it to him. And that was the proof that there was somebody up there, you see, the creator. And I thought that was the most beautiful story. Really, it's so true, you see. That testifies, more than really any words, to a designer behind the universe, to a creator, an artist, if you like, as well as everything else, behind the creation in which we live. I am hoping very much to write a a small booklet or brochure, a compilation with a little tiny bit of comment on the titles of Baha'u'llah and God in the Baha'i writings, because they're absolutely extraordinary. And the only time I've had to work on this the last few years was during the fast, because then I have some time that's really all my own, you see, after getting up and having breakfast before dawn, and then my dawn prayers, and then I have a little period before the day starts. And I've usually done my writing at that time. I did the writing of Prescription for Living at that time. And I'm hoping that this thing can be finished, you see, that maybe this fast I'll be able to finish it. And then that would be exactly what this man said. The titles of God in the Baha'i teachings are so extraordinary. The Fashioner, the Creator, the All-Merciful, the All-Powerful, the All-Generous, you see. And hundreds, almost, of other titles that are also wonderful. We are indeed very, very fortunate to be Baha'is. And I think that it's sad that somehow or other we cannot convey to other people in a way that they seem to be able to understand it. I mean people who are receptive spiritually, people who fundamentally are more or less already Baha'is in their thinking and their feeling and their outlook. But often we Baha'is, I feel, fail to make what the teachings of Baha'u'llah are like and their importance and what they can mean to us clear to other people. And I find so much of the time, especially when I'm giving public talks, I pray that I will not be a screen. That in these marvelous teachings that really have the answer for everything, and the people who are hearing what I am saying, because I realize that if I were clever enough to not in any way cut the other person off or turn them off, to use a modern expression, you see, they might be able to understand that the thing that they are looking for and the thing that they believe in and are really in their hearts longing to accept is this. But perhaps I'm so clumsy that I cannot convey it to them in a way that they can accept it. And I think that so many more people in the world would be Baha'is if we Baha'is were a little more clever and a little more tactful and knew how to do it a little bit better. I always tell the Baha'is that when a man goes fishing, he sets out to catch, say, sea trout or salmon. He uses different kinds of lures. He knows when the fish will be likely to rise. He knows where they may be likely to rise. And he goes about catching a fish. He doesn't do it haphazardly. He plans the whole thing with a tremendous amount of interest so that he can get his fish. And he does exactly the same thing when he goes hunting. Where are the deers or the rabbits or whatever it is? How can I get them? What kind of shot do I use? What hour of the day? Then I won't come back empty-handed. But too often the Baha'is don't have this attitude towards teaching the Baha'i faith. They just sort of like this, a fire hose technique, or I don't know, a pamphlet technique. You thrust a booklet on somebody and then you think that you've done your duty. Well, in a way you probably have. That we were awfully strong on that when I was a girl. We would hear all kinds of old ladies usually come back beaming from ear to ear. You see, they'd been out on a shopping tour or for a walk or something, and they had given the message, you see. Well, given the message meant they had shoved a pamphlet on somebody, whether they wanted it or whether they didn't. And it sometimes, of course, it may have been fruitful, but a lot of the time it was just wasted energy, because that technique and that approach to people, it didn't have any rapport with what another person was perhaps looking for or needed. So that I think that it's an art to teach the Baha'i faith. It's an art to convey this wonderful, wonderful message of Baha'u'llah to other people. And one person wants one thing from it and one person wants another. I don't know anything about the people here. I never saw any of you before. But I think that you go over your Baha'i background and your Baha'i friends and you find that some people are not particularly interested in prayer. People are more interested in prayer than when I was a girl. There's absolutely no comparison. The degree to which the Baha'is pray and turn to prayer now compared to when I was young is inconceivable. Maybe in Persia they were brought up differently and they prayed more and consistently. But I know in my own youth, of course we prayed. My mother came and heard my prayers every night of my life. Of course I prayed. I believed in prayer. If someone was sick, we had healing prayer. If they died, we had the prayer for the dead. If we wanted guidance or whatever it was, of course we prayed. But we didn't have this consciousness of the power of prayer that people have now. But aside from that, I think that there are people who are, for instance, immensely attracted to the hidden words, to some of the mystical tablets of Baha'u'llah, to the seven vows, and they're not particularly interested in the social or economic aspect of the teachings of Baha'u'llah. And there are other people who are interested in the teachings of Baha'u'llah that are, in other words, maybe we should put it this way, that there are people who are very attracted to everything in the teachings that has to do with individual salvation. And there are other people who are very attracted to everything in the teachings that has to do with building a new society in the world. You see, a new world order. Well, all right, we're different. We have different interests in life. We have different characteristics, and we have to remember that. And of course, as Baha'is, we should try gradually to round ourselves out, so that we will appreciate the teachings both for ourselves individually, gain the spiritual sustenance that we need from the writings, and at the same time have an understanding of the economic and social teachings of the faith, which are so important. Have we got enough chairs? There's a chair there for you. To be a well-rounded Baha'i is, after all, the thing that we should aim at. To have the both aspects of the teachings, the tremendously rejuvenating process that comes to us through reading the writings, through contemplating the words of Baha'u'llah, which isn't such a complicated thing as far as I'm concerned. People say, what is meditation? Well, you just sit down and look at it and think about it a little bit. You don't have to say om, om, and rock back and forth cross-legged or anything. You can meditate just by using your mind quietly to try and assimilate what it is that's in front of you. But all of these things are doors and ways of deepening our own understanding and perhaps eventually attracting other people to the teachings of Baha'u'llah. People, as I say, enter through different doors. And I think that the friends must be very careful not to put up any barriers between themselves and the public. I know people are surprised because they never hear me say Allahu Akbar. And they never do, you know. I go to meetings and I get off airplanes and nobody ever hears me say Allahu Akbar, except to the Persians, because then I'm talking Persian. And in Persia, the Persian Baha'is began to use this term at a period when there had to be a differentiation between those who were the followers of Baha'u'llah and those who were not. And the use of this Allahu Akbar came in at that time. And when one person said to another, Allahu Akbar, you immediately knew that this is one of those who have come forward from the Babi dispensation and accepted Baha'u'llah, you see, as the one promised by the Bab. So there was a period and a picture there. Abdul Baha says that in the future, Allahu Akbar will be the greeting. Well, he didn't say when, he said in the future, you see. Shoghi Effendi wrote, and it has been published a number of times and republished, and originally when The Guardian wrote it, oh, maybe 30 to 35 years ago, and then at least twice since then in the American Baha'i News, in other words, the International Baha'i News, that we should use this greeting of Allahu Akbar in such a way as not to be a test to other people. Now, I'm sure you all use it amongst yourselves. I'm just sharing my thoughts with you on different subjects. But I think we have to be very careful not to use it in front of non-Baha'is or non-Baha'i relatives who don't understand what it means. Because when somebody hears one of us say Allahu Akbar and another person answers Allahu Akbar, if I said abacadabra, it would might mean more to that person than Allahu Akbar, you see. It doesn't mean anything to anybody but us. And so we have to be very careful not to become identified in the minds of other people as peculiar. Who are these people that go around shouting this strange word at each other? We're already a little peculiar to begin with. And then if we add this to it, you see, it's often too much. I know I'm a good person to talk about this because I have on my father's side of the family many relatives, first cousins, and first cousins once removed, and their children now, who are not Baha'is, you see. And of course I would love to have my family become Baha'is because I would feel that they were coming forward in history into the message of God for this period, for humanity, you see. I don't want them to stay back on something that was perfect for a period, but now something has come that is perfect for this period, the continuation of that, in other words, in this period of history. And I want them to become Baha'is, to put it bluntly. And I have never introduced them to any Baha'is because I couldn't run the risk, knowing my extremely conservative Canadian relatives. I knew that if they ever went to a Baha'i meeting and heard a lot of people shouting Allahu Akbar at each other, they would be completely put off. And of course in those days, thank God they've stopped it now to a great extent, but there was so much kissing. The men would rush at each other, not only a big Allahu Akbar, but woo, you know. And I said, just let them see that once. And these Canadian men relatives of mine are going to say, oh no, that's no place for me. So you have to be very careful, you see. You have to not be a test to any other person, not to chase away the very people, you see, that you're trying to catch, so to speak. And I think that this is something that all of us have to consider. Everything is always different when you're on the inside. If somebody's out there looking into this room at us, it's going to be quite different from us looking out at them. The outside looking in, the inside looking out, two entirely different positions. And I think that often we Baha'is don't realize that if you listen to us, I don't know, as I say, it has nothing to do with mull, it's only some general observations on my part. But if you listen to a group of Baha'is talking, and very often in front of their non-Baha'i relatives and friends, oh, they say, of course, I got a letter from the NTC the other day, and they told me that the ITC said this and that, and the NSA said this, and the something or other said that, and the BM said this, and the assistant said that. You know, it sounds like one of these big firms that has an inter-office series of abbreviations. Really, think of it. It's just the same thing. People in banking, people in big insurance companies, I'm sure that all of these departments have been abbreviated, and they just bat these funny little terms that are entirely internal back and forth amongst themselves. And if you don't happen to be in that circle, you haven't the faintest idea what they are talking about. Would you believe it that sometimes in Haifa, amongst the secretaries of the House of Justice, I hear them using abbreviations that I don't know what they are. And I get so angry. I say, what are you talking about? Oh, well, we're talking about the finance department of the section of something. I said, well, can't you say so? What's this nonsense that you're talking in all of this little Chinese back and forth amongst yourselves? It's really ridiculous. You see, we cease all too easily to be objective. Well, all right, a couple of secretaries of the House of Justice want to, for some unknown reason, abbreviate something. And so they say, well, I got a telephone call from the, Israel Affairs Department, would it be, I suppose, the IF, I don't know, but anyway.
You're making it up.
I let's go back and try that on. I see they know what I'm talking about. But
I see.
No, but really, we do this, you see, without realizing that for other people, they really don't know what we're talking about. We're talking a kind of jargon. And I think that we have to be very, very careful of these things. When I was a child, there were so with so little administration, and the cause was on such a small scale, very much like the scale of Mull was practically the scale of the whole of the east of Canada. We didn't have these things, you see, because we didn't have a big enough administration to have developed these abbreviations. Of course, NSA is an abbreviation we all knew just because we're too lazy to say National Spiritual Assembly. But within limits, I think that these are points that it is very necessary for us to remember. I often wonder whether people in places like this realize how important they are. And I say that without any, as the Persians say, ta'aruf, no compliment intended. I used to tell the Baha'is, traveling in Africa, I said, you know, in the villages, used to say, look, each one of you who has accepted the teachings of Baha'u'llah is like a candle that has been lighted. And that's a very wonderful thing. You just light the only one little flame, one little candle, but it's there. In the darkness, one candle can be quite bright, and certainly a lot better than no candle. So you are, you individual Baha'is, you isolated Baha'is, you little groups, whatever you are, you're just like little candle flames burning in the dark. Then you get a local spiritual assembly. I said, well, the local spiritual assembly is like one of these kerosene lamps, that you pressure lamps, you see. You pump it up, and it gives a lot more light. And then you're going into a higher power, because you have your administrative body, and your administrative body functions as a unit in the administration throughout the whole world, and because of that, you are giving forth a much brighter light, you see. Then you have your national assembly. I said your national spiritual assembly is very much like electricity. You get into a different kind of power. It's much more brilliant. It's like electrical light, which of course is much greater than just the light of a kerosene lamp. But the house of justice is like the light of the sun. You get degrees, in other words, of light. And I think that the Baha'is have to appreciate themselves, because often they get discouraged. And they say, well, I'm just one person here. You know, I'm tired of being one person. I'm tired of being all alone. I'm tired of nobody ever caring that I'm here, and I'm not getting anywhere. And nobody is the least interested in Baha'i teachings. And what am I doing here? I better go back and pioneer somewhere else, or go home, or whatever their feeling may be. But they don't realize that however insignificant they may seem to themselves, they are nevertheless a little candle burning in the dark. And the spread of these candles over the countryside obviously is very important. This is why we attach so much importance to teaching the faith wherever we go, so that we can gradually begin to get more light going through having these different Baha'is and isolated Baha'is, then local spiritual assemblies, which are our administrative units, eventually our national spiritual assemblies. But the Guardian attached a tremendous importance to people in the kind of situation that you are here in Hull. It's altogether different from being a Baha'i 20 miles out of Glasgow or Edinburgh or London, where you have infinitely more amenities if you want them. If you're wise, you won't want them, but if you're foolish and want them, you don't have them here, you see. It's quite a different setup. And he attached infinitely more importance to isolated communities in difficult surroundings. Now, mind you, I don't consider that to live here with good fresh air and something that hopefully didn't come out of a tin can to eat, and people who are much cleaner living than people who are in the heart of our big cities nowadays, where there's so such a tremendous amount of moral corruption, corruption because they have no standard of honesty, corruption, they have no standard of truthfulness, moral decadence, polluted air, the whole atmosphere of cities, the danger of crime, and so on. I think that people who live in this environment are the lucky ones. And if I didn't have my own kind of work to do in this world, and my home wasn't in Haifa, and I didn't have to go home and sit down in Haifa and write a book, which I hope to write, and a few other things, you see, well, I would much rather be out here, only of course I'd rather be even further away, I'd rather be in Africa or somewhere very much further away. But my idea of a marvelous place to be, especially if I had children, would be in a place like this. And I don't know how you convey that to the Baha'is. Because in these islands that I have been to the last week, maybe the people are fanatical. I picked up the paper this morning in Stornoway and had a look at it. And, the Sabbath had been desecrated, you know, wow. It was quite a thing. I don't know what they did. Oh, they had the beginning of a cultural festival. And it started on the Sabbath, the Lord's Day, you see, had been desecrated. Well, when I was a child, Toronto was what we called the Blue City. I don't know whether you ever had that term here, but we called them blue laws. And they were the laws that you couldn't do anything on the Sabbath, you see. And at the risk of somebody biting my head off or thinking I'm a heretic, I'll tell you what my mother used to say. She said, you know, I like so much the Catholic Church because all it ever asks its followers to do is to go to Mass on Sunday. And of course you have the confession, you have absolution, so on, penance and whatnot. But fundamentally you've got to go to Mass on Sunday. And she said the rest of the day they can have a good time. They can eat, they can go out to the golf course, they can go out and the children can play and have a good time. The rest of the day is the day of rest for the people to enjoy themselves, you see. And Mother heartily approved of that, and she thought blue laws were simply awful. And it was so bad in Toronto that children weren't allowed to go sliding in the park on Sunday. You couldn't take your sleigh out and slide in the park in Toronto on Sundays, but in Montreal you could have a whale of a good time on Sundays, you see. Go sliding on Mount Royal and all kinds of things. And I think that perhaps many of the people in this part of the world are deeply conservative, you see, and very conservative in their religion, and along with their conservatism, very prejudiced against anything different, particularly if it has to do with the concept of a new faith, you see. Either they think you're crazy, or you're one of these really crazy sects that are running around the world today, or one of these peculiar isms, or they think you're just damned because you're heretics, you see. You've got a hold of a false prophet and you are following the false prophet's teachings and you're in great danger spiritually and so on. It's just that attitude towards you, but then not all the people are like that. Many of the people are getting more and more open-minded. Many of the people on these islands are slowly coming to accept the teachings of Baha'u'llah, and probably a great many more of them would accept it if they would only listen, you see. But they won't listen because they never get far enough towards us to even hear what it is we're trying to say. So if they don't hear what we have to say, then how are you going to convince them that it's not so bad after all if they would just listen to it, you see? Well, all right, that's your problem. That is a difficulty that you are faced with in these islands. But then you have a power, you have a weapon, if you like, which the Spiritual Assembly was telling me about at lunchtime, which I think is very wonderful. You have the weapon of prayer connected, as I feel that it should be connected now, with the Baha'is who have been martyred in Persia, you see. As I told the friends in the youth conference in Kansas City and the one here in England, why not draw on these wonderful souls that in our own lifetime, 2 months ago, 10 months ago, a year and a half ago, have been willing to die rather than recant their belief in Baha'u'llah, you see. After all, they have risen to the highest station that can be reached on this planet. Remember that hidden word, I can't quote the whole thing all the way through, he said, write all that we have revealed unto thee with the ink of light upon the tablet of thy spirit. Then I forget the second part. And then he says, if this be not within thy power, then write with that crimson ink. Sweeter indeed is this to me than all else. The ink of martyrdom, you see. Well, we have Baha'is that are giving their life with that same spirit that characterized the 20,000 martyrs in the early days of our faith. I never thought I would live to see it. Never thought it, frankly, could come back. And it's a revelation, certainly, to people of my age, and then how much more to you young people. Well, the point is, those people die in a very exalted frame of mind. And, of course, as far as we're concerned, you die and you're alive. So they must be very much alive and probably only too willing to help. So if we turn to them and ask them to help, understanding who they are, not having any funny ideas about them, but just say, all right, you who have given your lives, you recent martyrs who have died just a short time ago because you would not recant your belief in Baha'u'llah, you help us. We need your help. Guide us to people that are receptive. Help those people to be more receptive. Help them to understand how wonderful these teachings are, which were sufficiently wonderful for you to die for, you see. And I think that combined with prayer, can open a great many doors before the Baha'is at this time. And I think that this is a fact that is going to become more and more apparent as time goes by. I think that undoubtedly the persecution of these Persian brothers and sisters of ours and their sufferings are going to have repercussions all over the world. It seems very sad that this should be the way we have to do it. It's sad that things should reach a point in Persia where they get killed. It's twice as sad almost that we should require their being killed to buck up and do more ourselves and draw on the spiritual powers of the faith and the spiritual powers of the Supreme Concourse to help us, you see. But never mind, let's do what we can here today. Never mind crying over spilt milk and saying, well, we should have done this, we should not have done that, we could have done more. Let's go on from where we are now. And I think that this is something that we're going to see happening everywhere in the Baha'i world, a tremendous increase in the momentum of teaching and a great increase of interest in the faith on the part of many people of all kinds of backgrounds, including people in these islands. There are so many examples amongst the Baha'is that you hear all the time of how they are guided to the faith and how they happen to accept the faith. I remember a story that always rather tickled me. A young English Baha'i came some years ago to Haifa. And at that time, well, this must be what, maybe 10 years ago at least. And he was on the National Youth Committee. Now he's probably in his early middle age. But then he was a relatively new Baha'i, a very active, devoted Baha'i. He was about 25 at that time. And I asked him, in those days we didn't have so many pilgrims the way we have now, so I could see them really more on an intimate basis of 8 or 10 people at one time instead of 40 or 45 people in a meeting. And I asked this young man, how did you become a Baha'i? And he said, well, he'd gone out to Australia, thought of emigrating there, and he had the only job that he could get was selling the New Testament. And he wasn't a Baha'i at all, and he didn't believe in any, he was an atheist. But he thought, well, if he could earn his living selling the New Testament, it was a nice illustrated copy, well, that was fine anyway to earn his living, you see, because he was out of work. So he went around peddling this Bible from one place to another, and he went to a house and rang the bell, and a woman came and asked him what he wanted, and he said that he had a very beautiful copy of the New Testament he'd like to show her. He said, "I don't want it, not interested." Well, he said, "Madam, if you just let me show it to you, it's illustrated, it's no commitment on your part, but just at least look at it." She said, "I don't want to look at it. I don't want a copy of the New Testament. I don't need it." And he said, "Well, why?" She said, "Look, I'm in a hurry." And she started to close the door on him, put his foot in the door. He said, "Why?" She said, "I'm a Baha'i." He said, "What's a Baha'i?" "Look," she said, "I'm in a hurry. There's a meeting at such and such an address on Wednesday night. You go there, you can find out." And she was evidently dying to teach the Baha'i faith. I don't know, maybe the baby was howling or the soup was boiling over. I don't know what her circumstances are. I never found out. But anyway, he was sufficiently curious to go to the Baha'i meeting. And after 2 weeks, he enrolled as a Baha'i, because he liked the social and economic teaching so much. He thought that this concept of a new world order and everything that went into it, you see, and the way the Baha'i administration functioned, the plan of the administration, the plan for the future, was marvelous. All of that he believed in. So he accepted it and he became a Baha'i. And I said, "What about believing in God?" Oh, he said, "I didn't believe in God." I said, "Well, didn't they ask you?" "No," he said, "they asked me if I believed in Baha'u'llah." And I said, "I thought the teachings of Baha'u'llah were wonderful. They were just what the world needed, you see." So he became a Baha'i. We're going to need some more chairs.
His friends have missed a boat.
Ferry?
Yes, a ferry.
From where?
From Oban.
Oh.
They come from Glasgow and Stirling.
Why, can't we get any more chairs in here?
Yes.
Well, look, you two can sit down again and he can sit down here. Anyway. So he said, "No, I didn't. Nobody asked me if I believed in God." And I said, "Then you were still an atheist when you became a Baha'i?" He said, "Yes." Well, I looked at him. I said, "Are you an atheist now?" He said, "No, now I believe in God." Well, I said, "What happened?" "Well," he said, "I began to read the prayers and the writings, and then gradually my point of view changed." Now, that was one of the most exciting things that ever happened to me in my life. I know that we can't advertise for atheists to accept the Baha'i faith and say they don't have to believe in God to be Baha'is. But the fact that this fellow could be so taken with the teachings of Baha'u'llah, you see, and so thrilled over this concept of a new world order as to accept it, and that nobody, who would ever dream of asking a person that wanted to be a Baha'i if they believed in God? It never enter your head. It's nowhere in the teachings you have to say you believe in God, you see. You presume that that's the starting point, you see, so you never ask them. And nobody ever asked him, and he became a very devoted and happy and active young Baha'i who did gradually get it through his head that there was a God and he believed in him, you see. But I always thought that was such a wonderful story, the way different people enter the faith through different doors, in different states of mind, in different spiritual states, if you like. And I've always thought there had to be room for all of them. I never can understand. Of course, if you have people that are desperate troublemakers inside of a community, let's put it that way, and you warn them and warn them and warn them, and they go on raising hell and wrecking the faith locally, well then of course you have to consider whether it'd be better to deny them administrative activity so that they can't be so disruptive. But that very seldom happens. And I've often thought that there really must be room for every human being inside the Baha'i faith. There's got to be room for people who have very limited understanding. Take an old villager, for instance, in Africa who's illiterate. They don't know anything about anything, really, that we do. They may know about their own local culture and local customs and food and agriculture and village way of living, but they don't know anything about anything else. So how are you going to tell them what we know with our degree of learning and background about the teachings of Baha'u'llah. You can't. They're never, never, never going to be able to know it. But is that any reason why they shouldn't be Baha'i? No reason at all, you see. They have a perfect right to hear about Baha'u'llah and accept him. I remember once in a meeting that Violetta and I were in a very big village in India, about 1,000 villagers, and everybody spoke, and I spoke, and the local priest, who was the Hindu custodian of the local temple, in his orange robes, was sitting up at the top of the meeting. And he got more and more excited over what we were saying. And at the end of the meeting, he turned and he said, "Can I say something?" And the Indians are wonderfully relaxed people, you know. They don't get all tied up over things and think it's going to go wrong or you have to have it according to page 382 or something. So he said, "Certainly, go ahead and speak." He got up and he began to recapitulate what we had been saying that Baha'u'llah taught. But when he came to the word Baha'u'llah, he couldn't remember it. So he turned around and he said, "And..." And they said, "Baha'u'llah. And Baha'u'llah says this, you see." And he went on and he would tell his audience again what Baha'u'llah had said. He'd forget it again when he got further on. "Baha'u'llah. Oh yes, Baha'u'llah. Well, you know, a long time later, on another trip to India, Mrs. Bowman had been my translator and traveling with us, and I said, "Shireen, what became of that man? You remember that priest that day in that meeting, and he became a Baha'i, and we enrolled him, and so on? What became of him?" "Oh," she said, "he's a very devoted Baha'i." So it's so thrilling to see things like this. So many people entering from so many different doors. Once we had a meeting in the airport, and we could scarcely duplicate it out here, but we could in this large airport in one of the cities of India. The plane was late, so we sat around, and all the Baha'is, you know, that had come to see us off, and we just talked Baha'i meeting, and some of the people that were working at the airport were very intrigued. What were these two strangers doing wearing saris, you see? And above all, why were we so close to these Indians? Just like one big family, you see, laughing and talking and first names and such a happy atmosphere, and they were very intrigued. So they came and they just stood there and listened. And before we left India, some months later, there was a big conference, and a man got up and spoke very beautifully about the faith, and then he said, "You don't recognize me, do you?" I said, "No, should I?" He said, "I'm one of the people who was standing in the airport that day." And just that contact, you see, with the Baha'is had such an effect on him and attracted him so much that he had gotten Baha'i books and read them and became a very active and devoted Baha'i. But you have so many different ways of teaching the Baha'i faith and different responses to it that it's really very, very thrilling. I remember when we were in the Andes in Ecuador, the tail end of the Inca Empire, and a perfectly adorable Baha'i whom I love with all my heart, his name is Rufino, and he's about that high. And I don't know how many people he's brought into the faith, probably thousands, literally. And Rufino, he's a farmer, he goes walking, you see, I think he's getting now too old to walk, but he'd go walking in the mountains, and he would go into the home of one of the Indians. They always welcome you, little tiny homesteads, very much like these islands, you know, not people close to each other because the land won't permit it. So there's a little homestead there in their land and then another one over there and so on. So he went into this, he would go into this place, and they keep their hats on, they wear their ponchos and they wear their hats. But if they take their hat off, then it means that this is something very, very important. It's spiritual. Because in church, they would be taught, you see, when they went to the church, the Catholic church, they would take their hat off out of respect for being in the church. So Rufino would take his old battered felt hat off, and then he would just tell them that there was a very wonderful message that had come from God in this age, and that the name of the person who had brought this message to the world was Baha'u'llah. And then he would look at them, he'd say, can you say Baha'u'llah? And they would be very hesitant, such a strange word, you know, compared to their Quechua language. And then he'd say, Baha'u'llah, and then very hesitantly, you see, they would follow the words and just say it, Baha'u'llah, and they would say, Baha'u'llah. He put his hat back on his head and walk off, and he said, I will come again sometime, and when I come, I will tell you more. And this was his teaching method, you see. And I know Raoul Pavon, who is one of the counselors, taught and teaches very much in the same way. And he would go into the houses of these people and he would say, can you say Baha'u'llah? And he would get them to say it. He'd say, you know, through this word, your home has been blessed. Your house has received a blessing through hearing the name of Baha'u'llah. Because he is the one in this age that has brought a message from God and so on. And he'd say, I'll come back, and off he goes. Not this fire hose business, you see. And in the Akdas it says this, in the 19-day feast, in the name of the 19 months, in the name of the Wawhead and the Bahid, in the name of this, in the name of that, you see, on and on and on, until sometimes the so-called contact is absolutely prostrated. And they never want to hear the word Baha'i or Baha'u'llah or anything else again as long as they live, because you've literally suffocated them with it. Now, I don't know how you should teach in Hull. Please don't think that I'm giving you any kind of suggestions. I haven't the faintest idea. I'm sure you know your own business, judging by the number of people in this room, better than I know mine, certainly here. But the thing is, it's so wonderful to see the way the Baha'is teach in different parts of the world, and the results, how so many people enter through entirely different doors. I remember when Ali, Violette's husband, you know, the member of the Universal House of Justice, Mr. Nakhchivani, when he went up, Shoghi Effendi said in 19, what was it, Violette, what year was the first conference? He invited the African. In 53, the midpoint of the crusade, he said that some of the Africans he wanted to ask, because this was the first place in the world we had so-called mass conversion, and he wanted to ask some of them to come as his guest to attend that conference. And they were about 200 miles away from Kampala. So Ali went up and invited some of the villagers, the Baha'is, whom he had taught with other people, and who knew him personally, to get on these buses and come down for this marvelous continental conference, and be present as the guest of the guardian. All the expenses were being paid by Shoghi Effendi. And they had a hard time, you know, having enough confidence to come. But finally, he got them together, and they were going back on the buses, and their women were petrified because they thought they'd never see them again, thought they were going to be taken off perhaps into slavery. And they wept and they hung on to their men. Had a hard time getting these 150 or so Baha'i men to come down to the conference because the women were so frightened and upset. Mr. Oloro, who is one of the counselors for Africa, wonderful, wonderful Baha'i, and knew a little more, and a little more education than the average villager. Some of them were literate, but just barely. But he'd been in the British Army for some time, and he had naturally more education and traveled a little bit. And he came and found everybody in a furor that we don't know where these men have gone. They've been taken off to Kampala. So he got on a bus and came down to Kampala to see that the villagers were all safe, you see, and everything was all right. And then, of course, he became a Baha'i. And he was a wonderful Baha'i. But think of it, that's not long ago. That's in 53. They were so afraid still of the white man. I mean, unless he was just in the picture the way he would normally be as they knew him, but not coming and saying, get on a bus and come as guest of the head of your faith down to Kampala for a conference. Then there was the Persian pioneer who was headed for Africa, and he was on a boat that had a lot of Arabs on it and people, the Muslims of that part of, of the coast, and they asked him where he was going. And I think he was going to Kampala too, wasn't he? Somewhere, or Kenya anyway, somewhere in the Tanzania, Kampala, Uganda or Kenya. And they said, don't you know what you are doing? And he was a very simple Baha'i from Persia. He said, don't you realize the danger you are running? Those people eat other people. You may be eaten. You are mad, you see, to risk your life by going into the interior and visiting these people. So look at what the Baha'i faith is, and look at the reaction. One side the African reaction of fear, one side the non-African, if you like, reaction of fear. These fascinating things take place all over the Baha'i world. Different doors, different people enter the faith by different methods. And in the end, the likeness between the Baha'is is simply unbelievable. And I'm sure that all of you feel that. Wherever you go, you see, when you go to a conference, wherever it may be, summer school or down to a big meeting somewhere, and there are Baha'is from other places and other countries, and you're simply astonished at how much these Baha'is are exactly like you. As I always tell non-Baha'i audiences, we are the only truly international thing in the whole world. The United Nations is international in theory, but it neither really functions internationally because of Caucasus and the non-aligned states and the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc and so on. Great world religions, far as they are spread over the planet, say like the Catholic Church or Islam, still they are not united. There's a great deal of sectarianism, there's a great deal of difference. One priest goes into politics and becomes a political figure in his own country, and then there's a tremendous opposition against him, and still he is a Catholic priest or a Protestant minister, whatever it is. Nothing in the whole world is as international and as closely and happily knit together as the Baha'is. Now, if we could only convey this image to other people so that they could see that this is the truth, that they could only understand it. And of course, I think this is our mission. We don't have any kind of priests, so it is our privilege to tell other people about the Baha'i faith. And we're not forced to do it, but we are allowed to do it, you see. I think this is what the Baha'is must realize. There's no pressure in the faith. There is pressure from the standpoint of time. Time is short. Sometimes people ask me, well, why all this pioneering? Why all this rushing around? Why does a Baha'i have to get up and leave their town and job and go to another place and teach the faith there? And maybe their old mother doesn't like it, or they're not going to get paid as much, or the school isn't as good, or something like that, you see. And the answer to that is that I always say it's like being on a boat. If you are on a pleasure cruise, everything is fine and comfortable, and you are enjoying your experience of traveling. But if the boat catches on fire, then the whole condition changes. You're no longer sitting around getting brown in deck chairs or having a nice meal in the lounge or whatever it may be. It's all hands on deck in order to save the boat, because the boat is also saving your life, you see. And this is the emergency. This is what the Baha'is have to realize, and I think non-Baha'is must realize it too, that all this fuss that we make about hurrying up and teaching, you see, and coming in contact with other people and offering them the Baha'i faith, because we can't force it on them under any circumstances, the urgency is that if we don't do it now, it may be too late. Otherwise, in the future, the Baha'is aren't going to rush around like mad, trying to tell other people about the faith, trying to establish local Baha'i assemblies and so on, because it will all have been done. So that the whole picture will be changed. Nothing will be in the condition that it was before. And I think that people should understand that. I think they should understand that they can be Baha'is without necessarily being just like the next fellow. And I think that this is one way that we Baha'is, in many cases, are extremists. Because we give the impression that if you become a Baha'i, you've got to be like me, you see. Well, maybe I'm particularly active. Maybe I have sacrificed myself. Maybe I have traveled. And whatever it is that I am doing, you see, you say, well, I can't do that. Well, you don't have to do it. That's the answer. I don't have to be like you. You don't have to be like me. I have to do what I feel that I can and want to do as a Baha'i. But I don't have to follow the pattern of any other person, except just to be a Baha'i in a normal sense of the word. I think it would be nice if we had some questions.
A gentleman who yesterday very kindly offered to get me on a course, and if he can get me on it, it means I can travel throughout the Orkney Islands.
Well, by all means, I like the Orkneys very much, so I think that's a lovely thought. I hope you get it.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to have seen you.
I just saw a rush of hands get up there. I don't know what.
Just moved
by. Oh, right.
Wishing her good luck, not asking me questions.
Really?
With so many people asking questions at the moment, is there not any possibility in recent and some answer questions because such a valuable group?
Well, I think that the answer to that, I quite agree with you, that the answer, some answered question, very, very valuable book. But, unfortunately, it is very poorly stated in English. You see, you have to remember that the person, as I recall, who did most of the translation was one of the daughters of Abdu'l-Bahá, who spoke, you know, just like that. She had learned some English. She wasn't an English scholar. And if you read it carefully, sometimes the terminology is so strange that you don't know what on earth it means, you see. It's phrases that we are not familiar with in English. I've been weaned on some answered questions. I read it all my childhood and girlhood, you see. But I find it very, very difficult to read some of the chapters of some answered questions now, because the meaning is not clear in the English language. You really don't know what it is that he's saying. And as Abdu'l-Bahá was always the essence of clarity, if you know Persian and you read the master's words in the original, they're as clear as lucid water, you see. So then you know that this cannot be exactly what he said, because he never could have said it in such a muddled manner. And I think that's the fault of the translator. Now, as I understand it, the house is reviewing it. And they are trying. I don't know, I haven't heard, because I'm traveling so much, you see, that they are entirely retranslating it from scratch. But I think that they're definitely trying to straighten it out, at least temporarily, till somebody does fundamentally retranslate the whole book into better English, and then it will be republished. And of course we'll just have to wait, but it really was confusing. She used terms that whatever they were in Persian, they're very misleading in English. I can't give you any examples. For instance, the ether. Well, the ether was a term at the beginning of the century, but what on earth does the ether mean nowadays in the 20th century? It doesn't really mean anything. I mean, it's the point of the 20th century.
Nobody have any questions? Must be questions there.
Well, in no hurry.
Go and join your dying act, Glenn.
No.
back. I've only come here once to see you all. It doesn't matter whether I'm tired or not. I'll go to bed tonight and get rested.
How often can you visit the Holy Land? How often can you visit the Holy Land?
Can we go to the Holy
Land? How often can we visit the Holy Land?
Oh, can you visit the Holy Land? Well, I think that you can visit the Holy Land as often as you can get permission. But now there's a long waiting list, as you know, for people to come on the pilgrimage, because the house can just manage to still treat the Baha'is to something that is of an intimate nature. When there's 40 Western Baha'is, or 45, you see, we can put them all on buses. We can have a Baha'i explain everything to them. They can, in a reasonable length of time, visit the shrine of Baha'u'llah, visit this place, visit that place. If there was 140, you could never get that kind of treatment. You'd probably have to be given a pamphlet, and you'd just go and do it on your own. There wouldn't really be any other way to do it, or the whole picture would have to change. So the House of Justice is trying very, very hard to preserve the period of intimacy as long as it can. But I don't know how much longer they will be able to do that, and I'm sure that they are aware of it too. But you can go to the Holy Land if you're traveling, or you wish to go there for 3 days, then you don't have to wait your turn, you see. And anybody just has to notify the House of Justice. And usually, I've never heard that anybody was refused, because usually it's a Baha'i in good standing, asks if they can come on a 3-day pilgrimage, and they're just streaming in and out all the time, on their way to Africa, on their way to Asia, back again to Europe, and so on, you see. And you see everything. You can go and visit the holy shrines, but you can't have that conducted part of the tour. You don't go and see the international archives, which are groups of 10 people, about 10, 15 people at a time on a conducted tour of it. And you can't go up into the mansion of Baha'u'llah, because we haven't a big enough staff to do it on a sporadic basis, you see. And as we do it with the pilgrims, we just haven't got the manpower to do it 3 days for this person, 3 days for that person, and so on. We'd have to have an immense staff working all the time. We can't do that. But you can do the most important thing. You can see all of these places from at least outside, and you can pray in the shrines. And Shoghi Pandit said that the purpose of the pilgrimage is to pray in the holy shrines. This is really the whole object of the pilgrimage. Everything else is added to that wonderful spiritual experience. Yes. Where did I come to meet Shoghi Effendi? Well, I think that's a very cute question. I'm glad somebody asked me. I was Baha'i from my birth. And when I was 12 years old, after the passing of Abdul Baha, he died in 1921, I was 11. And the next year, beginning in 1923, when I was still 12 years old, I went with my mother on a pilgrimage to Haifa. And in those days, the pilgrim house wasn't the one the House of Justice is in now. It was another little building. Very, very few pilgrims in those days, because all the travel, of course, was by boat, and things were a long way away and so on. And my mother wasn't well. She'd been very ill after Abdul Baha passed away, and she was in a wheelchair. So we got her to bed in the pilgrim house, and she was lying down in one of the rooms, and I was in this little hall of the pilgrim house, and there was a door and steps at that end where people came in, and the mother's room was here. And a young man came in, and he had a black hat on his head and a black coat just below his knees, and he swished. Had a tendency when he turned a corner to go like that, and this black coat sort of swished around him. And he came into the room and he said, "I'd like to see Mrs. Maxwell." And I said, "Well, you can't, because Mrs. Maxwell is lying down, and who is it that wishes to see him?" And he said, "I'm Shoghi Effendi." And I was petrified, absolutely petrified. So I was already about 4 inches taller than he was. And I rushed like mad into my mother's bedroom, and she was lying in bed, and I tried to get under the pillow behind her back, you see, like this, the way a puppy tries to get under something. Mother said, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "Shoggy Fenton, he's out there, and I didn't know who he was, and he wants to see you." Well, she said, "All right, you know, just getting quiet down." So she put something around her, and then I went and called the guardian, and he came and talked to my mother and inquired about her health, and was very, very loving and very kind. He was always very polite and very kind and considerate. So my mother couldn't walk, and she hadn't walked. She'd had a terrible, terrible breakdown, and she hadn't walked for over a year. And she couldn't walk from here to there. We had to push her chair over, and she'd get out of bed with difficulty and lie down, and then we'd help her get into the wheelchair, and it wasn't anything visible, but that's the way it was. So after we'd been there some time, we stayed a long time, my mother went up to the shrine. Shoghi Effendi called her and said she should come up to the shrine of the Bab, and everything was very different in those days. It wasn't built the way it is now. You see it in the pictures, and there was a long approach to it over a pebbled path. And there was a Baha'i, Montreal Baha'i, Mrs. Schafflocker there, and Shoghi Effendi, my mother was pushed in her wheelchair relatively near the door of the shrine, and then Shoghi Effendi said, "Now Mrs. Maxwell will visit the shrine." So he took her on one side, and Mrs. Schafflocker took her on the other, and they walked her, I don't know what, maybe the length of this room, I wasn't there, but something like that, and she collapsed. Passed right straight out, dead faint. And then they got people to come and carry her to the caretaker's house, and then finally I was told down in the town, and she was unconscious, I don't know for how many hours, right on, I think, up to the next morning. And of course I was terribly worried over my mother, and they brought the doctor, and she couldn't be moved, and she stayed up there on the mountain, and I had to go down to the pilgrim house and go to bed. And I can remember thinking, well, he's killed her, that's all. He may be the guardian of my faith, but he's killed my mother. I was in a pretty bad state, as you can imagine. But she'd been ill. I was used to her being so desperately ill, but I didn't expect her to be finished off. And she got a little bit better and was brought down. And she, you see, she had this terrible shock about Abdu'l-Bahá's passing away, and she had this idea, this was her illness, that she was never going to see Abdu'l-Bahá in the next world. I don't know why, something, a traumatic shock. Somebody phoned and said, "May you know, Abdu'l-Bahá has died," and she fainted. She wasn't very strong anyway. And this did something to her. And then she got this idea she was never, never going to see him again, not only in this world, but she wasn't going to be worthy to see him in that world. And then she really got sick, you see. And anyway, she couldn't walk for over a year and so on. So Shoghi Effendi used to tell her when she came to the pilgrim house table, he said, "The thoughts you are thinking, Mrs. Maxwell, are not true." And it was really a sort of therapy, his prayers, his kindness, and over again. I can remember hearing him say that. "The thoughts you are thinking, Mrs. Maxwell, are not true, you see." And gradually, he got this out of her mind. And after a year in the Middle East, he went to Switzerland, we went to Egypt, and then we came back again when he returned to the Holy Land, and we saw him again. And then on the way home, before we got back all the way to Montreal, somehow or other we lost that wheelchair. I forget what happened, but we got lost on the boat or something, and she never had one again. She never could walk very well. Couldn't see anything, but she couldn't walk very well. Didn't have the strength, but that was the end of the wheelchairs. So you could really say that Shoghi Effendi cured my mother of that illness. But I never knew that I was going to have the honor of marrying him. That was very unexpected. Where do you get your water on this island?
Oh, it's
well?
No, I think it's rainwater. Is it? A lot
spring?
Of rainwater. Rainwater. Yes.
No well water? No, but surely it must come down when it comes down in brooks and things
yeah.
from
mm-hmm.
the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Got to have some minerals, and
mm-hmm.
it's just
oh
not
yes.
off,
yes.
off
yes.
the
yes.
sky
yes.
like that.
There's a catchment place. You know, there's a peat. There's hill rocks.
You know,
it always comes off the hill and the
mm-hmm. Well, that's better. It's got some minerals in
oh,
it.
Oh, it's full of peat.
Oh boy, that's what gives it that sort of a color.
Yeah, yes.
You know, the best water I ever drank in my whole life was off the bottom of the jungles in Venezuela. Never tasted anything like it. And it's the drainage of the terrific rain, you see, that comes into the rivers really from under. And it was like wine. I've never drunk wine being a Baha'i, but I mean, it was marvelous. Never tasted anything like it. Well, do you have some more questions?
When do you think that the persecutions in Iran are going to finish?
I have no idea when the persecutions in Iran are going to finish, and I don't think the House of Justice knows when they're going to finish, or anybody on the planet knows when they're going to finish. Because I think that it's sort of Persia working herself up into one last terrific tantrum, so to speak. And if you think what that one country has done to the Bab, Baha'u'llah, and the Persian Baha'is during the course of over a century, then the punishment will be very, very terrible. You remember it says in the Quran, and it does say, it's quite an unbelievable passage, it says God prolongs the life of the evil doers so that they can compound their evil behavior. It's almost exactly like that if you remember the Quran. And it's as if you we say in English, give him enough rope and he'll hang himself, you see. And I think that this is really what it amounts to, that Persia has to burn itself up, this terrible, terrible element in Persia, these ghastly, fanatical, bloodthirsty priests from the days of the Bab and before the days of the Bab and after the days of the Bab and so on, whatever it is, it will have to burn itself out. And frankly, I want to see the day that Kemaf Nishe, I want to see it ground up until there's nothing left but powder, because what they have done to Baha'u'llah and the Bab and the martyrs is unbelievable. I mean, so inexcusable, such an innocent community, so defenseless, never in any way attacking back or undermining any government or any powers in Persia, to be treated like this. But this is something evidently that will have to take its course. Now how long that will be, I don't know, nobody knows. You tell me if we're going to have another war. Tell me how soon it might be. Tell me where it may start. You can't tell me, I can't tell you. We don't know what the future holds. Don't know what it holds in Persia. But what we do know is that Shoghi Effendi said that the immediate future, according to the writings, is very dark. But the distant future is very bright, you see. And what I may not live to see, you, being a generation younger, may. And these young people may actually live in a world that is at peace with the beginning of a world order. They may actually begin to see that fruition with their own eyes. But the immediate future for humanity is certainly dark. It can't be anything but dark, judging by what we see going on in the world. But the teachings of Baha'u'llah and all the prophecies of all the holy scriptures of the world foretell such a bright future that we know that there's a glorious future for mankind. The kingdom of God on earth, in other words, will certainly come.